It's for good reason that people are inspired by rags-to-riches stories. And I don't mean the Disney kind like Cinderella, even though that would be an illustration of it. I mean stories of real people whose circumstances were against them, but the hand of providence worked in such a way that their lives were upended in the way that they land on their feet, thriving more than they would have imagined. And people who were onlooking marvel at such a turn of events. These stories have the motif of someone starting in one position and then ending up in a very different one. The contributing factors aren't all the same. Maybe there's a talent that gets discovered. Maybe there's a certain person that takes notice. Maybe there's relentless hard work that finally seems to pay off. Maybe there was some obstacle in the way that finally removed now cannot stop the momentum any longer. There is something very human about rejoicing for someone who has overcome so much. This human element resonates with us, and that's one of the many reasons people love the story of Joseph in the Bible. Joseph has faced multiple obstacles, multiple descents that began in Genesis 37. His brothers rejected him. They were casting him into a pit. They sold him to Ishmaelite merchants who then took him to Egypt, and they sold him to Potiphar from Pharaoh's court. Joseph became a slave in Potiphar's house, and when Potiphar's wife made accusations against Joseph, Potiphar put Joseph in prison. All of that, we see circumstances, not only unideal, ones that Joseph would have never pursued if given the chance. And now in Genesis 41, everything changes in one glorious day. The story in this chapter causes the reader to root for Joseph. But these events are not in Joseph's hand. It's not as if he is engineering these. They're instead in the Lord's hand. God has brought Joseph to Egypt. God has superintended this whole 13 years outside the promised land for this young son of Jacob. God has a plan. And the near fulfillment of the plan will be realized in the years to come in Joseph's life. But there are things happening in Joseph's life that have far-reaching implications beyond his day, beyond even the Old Testament, things that will take us all the way to Christ. We need stories like Genesis 41, not just because we want to root for someone who's overcoming much. We need stories like Genesis 41 because it shows us that God can be trusted in the midst of circumstances that we don't understand. We are reminded that God has sovereign purposes. The breakdown of the passage is in three large parts. Verses 1 to 13, the account of Pharaoh's dreams, which we read a moment ago. In verses 14 to 36, the interpretation of Pharaoh's dreams. And in verses 37 to 57, the fulfillment of Pharaoh's dreams. We start in verses 1 through 13 with Pharaoh's dreams, which begin with him on the Nile. It tells us after two whole years, Pharaoh was standing by the Nile in his dream. Two whole years, then, that Joseph has been in prison. Two whole years since the previous episode when the cupbearer had promised to speak to Pharaoh a good word for Joseph. And yet we're told at the end of chapter 40, the cupbearer forgot about Joseph. These two full years take us probably to the same point in time that Genesis 40 verse 20 took us, which was Pharaoh's birthday. Pharaoh's birthday happened at the end of Genesis 40, and the cupbearer nonetheless forgot about Joseph, though the cupbearer was restored. And now 2 years have passed, and I think a good and plausible read of the beginning of our chapter this morning is that Pharaoh's birthday has come once more. And so the dream on this particular night is viewed as significant because of the timing. And it's not just one dream Pharaoh has. On this particular night, 2 years since the previous feast of Pharaoh's birthday, he has not one dream, but two. So 2 full years have passed and 2 dreams on one particular night, the timing likely Pharaoh's birthday, and not just that, the location of this ruler in his dream is important. Where is he? Not just anywhere, not in a back alley somewhere in Egypt, not in one of the marketplaces. He's standing by the Nile. And in the Nile River, we find great importance in ancient Egyptian literature. Ancient Egyptians believed that the very region of Egypt was a gift of the Nile itself, and that the Nile was personified in the Egyptian god Hapi. And so the sustenance and the life provided by this river was massively important to ancient Egyptians. So their pharaoh is beside it. And then weird things begin to happen in the Nile. It reminds us that this is indeed a dream because of the things we're going to read in verse 2. Behold, there came up out of the Nile seven cows. Now, of course, that doesn't happen. That's very strange. This is dreamlike. Have you ever dreamt anything strange? You can see in Pharaoh this exact kind of graphic language that would fit only in a dream world. Out of the Nile, here come seven cows, attractive and plump. Not only is the Nile important in Egypt, so are cattle. Cattle are important not just because they give food and milk, though they certainly give that. People use leather from the cows and even sacrifice them. The Egyptians conceived that certain gods took the form of cattle as well. In Pharaoh's dream, the Nile River is present and seven cows that are plump and attractive, which is to say, they're the kinds of cattle that somebody would want in Egypt because of the potential for food, sacrifice, milk, and all the rest. These then are images in Pharaoh's dream that help connect Egypt to prosperous time, thriving images, fertility and life, the Nile, these cattle. What happens next is unsettling. In verse 3, behold, seven other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. We should imagine 14 cattle at this point, seven that are good and seven then that are bad. And what happens as Pharaoh watches these cattle by the Nile? Well, in verse 4, the ugly, thin cows ate up the seven attractive, plump cows, and Pharaoh woke up. Now, that feels like a negative end to something, because these cattle that were plump and attractive were the kinds of things that you would want. And yet these kinds of cattle are consumed by something that you wouldn't want. Holding that thought, he falls back asleep and in verse 5 has a second dream. Different images, but the same point takes place. In verse 5, behold, there were seven ears of grain, also crucial in Egyptian life. These things are crucial to the life and flourishing of Egypt. The Nile, cattle, grain. These are not bonus extra motifs in Egypt. No, these are major, major things that people care about. And seven ears of grain that are plump and good are growing on one stalk. Oh, this would be a delight to the person in that agricultural background. And in verse 6, after them sprouted seven ears that were thin and blighted by the east wind. And then what happened with the seven good cows happens to the seven good ears of grain. In verse 7, the thin ears swallowed up the seven plump full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, probably in a cold sweat at this point. What in the world is happening? Given the timing of this, given the images of what's important to Egypt's life, what does it mean that these things connected to our life and sustenance are being consumed? It tells us in verse 8, he woke in the morning with his spirit troubled. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all of his wise men, because Pharaoh has dream interpreters at his beck and call. Ancient Near Eastern peoples even had dream books where symbols and motifs from dreams could lend themselves to certain conclusions and interpretations. And so he gathers all of his magicians in, all of his wise men in his Egyptian court, and he tells them his dreams. But here's the frustration. They may have made suggestions, they may have tried, but nonetheless are unable to tell him what it means. It says there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. But there is someone there. And though this person is not a dream interpreter, everything changes as the chief cupbearer steps forward. Now we know this figure, this chief cupbearer, is from chapter 40. And a cupbearer is someone who served the king the cup of wine, and it was a very important action in the ancient world, because people might try to assassinate the king, and so the person who served him his drink had to be very trustworthy. This person had to make sure that no one had doctored the drink, and in many cases, the cupbearer himself would sample the drink to ensure that it was safe for the king. So among the magicians and among the wise men, you've got this right-hand servant of the cup, if you will. And the cupbearer, all of a sudden, has his memory provoked by what's happening. What has provoked his memory? Here's discussion of someone who had troubling dreams and doesn't know what they mean. The cupbearer knows exactly what that feels like. Because 2 years earlier, the cupbearer had been in prison and he had had dreams. And when Joseph rightly interpreted the dreams, Joseph had said, "Now when you get the chance, as soon as it's well with you, please mention me to Pharaoh so I can get out of this pit." But the cupbearer forgot about Joseph. And it says here in the cupbearer's words, "I remember my offenses today." When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, we dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. Those two dreams, the cupbearer had dreamt of a vine that grew grapes much faster than you would have imagined grapes to grow. And then he squeezed those grapes into the cup and put that cup in Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph had said, "Well, what that means is you're going to be restored to your office as cupbearer in 3 days." And then the baker had an unsettling outcome for his dream. He had baskets on his head with bread in the top, but birds were consuming the bread. And so the bread never got to Pharaoh. And Joseph said, "It won't be well with you. You will be hanged while the cupbearer will be restored." So two different dreams with their own interpretation. Here in verse 12, the cupbearer says to Pharaoh, "There was a young Hebrew there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. And when we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream." Now we know that though Joseph's name isn't mentioned, there isn't anybody else in view. From chapter 40, we know this young Hebrew in chapter 41 is Joseph. In verse 13, here's what Pharaoh really needs to know. The cupbearer says, "And as he interpreted to us, so it came about." We don't need someone who's just giving speculation and interpretations that might not come to pass. But if we've got a guy that you can tell your dreams to and he can tell you what they mean and then that happens, well, then this is going to get Pharaoh's attention. Because Pharaoh's asked his magicians, he's asked all of his wise men, and nobody knows. This would certainly pique his interest. The cupbearer says, "I was restored to my office and the baker was hanged." In verses 14 to 36, the interpretation of Pharaoh's dreams unfold this way. "Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph." This set of verbs, that they called him and they quickly brought him and he had shaved himself and changed his clothes and came in. All of this string of verbs happens so fast in the original language. It's a way of saying that the pace in the story picks up with suspense. So here's Joseph in prison. He's been there 2 years. No cupbearer has come saying, "I spoke of you to Pharaoh." He has no doubt been discouraged on multiple occasions during these 2 years because he's been forgotten. Yet, Joseph is here in prison. And though he had hoped for release, 2 years have passed. And now this day comes and someone enters, and maybe it was even the cupbearer. It might have been a little awkward at first because 2 years had gone by, but nonetheless, Pharaoh sent and the cupbearer knows Joseph, knows exactly where he's at, knows what he looks like. And he goes to Joseph and Joseph is summoned. Can you imagine what that conversation must have entailed? "Joseph, come with us. You need to shave. You need to change." I don't know what would be going on in Joseph's mind, but surely he asked at some point, "Where are we going?" And then the words he'd been longing to hear would have included to go see Pharaoh. "Joseph, that's where we're going. Coming out of this prison, we're going to Pharaoh." Joseph no doubt realized things were coming to pass in a new and fresh direction, given these 2 years of imprisonment. Perhaps he thought the cupbearer finally remembered him. But indeed, it was Pharaoh's dreams that triggered it. It tells us in verse 14, when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, in other words, making Joseph presentable. It tells us that they had quickly brought him out of the pit. And even though this isn't a pit, like a dug cistern in the wilderness that his brothers threw him in, Joseph earlier referred to this prison as a pit. Because it's as if he went from one pit to another. And even though he's in prison, he says, they're going to bring me out of this pit too. So just as he left the pit and the cistern in the wilderness and went to Potiphar's house, he's going to leave the pit of the prison and go to Pharaoh's house. And in verse 15, he comes before Pharaoh. He's shaved. He's got new clothing. After all, clothing is important in the story of Joseph. In chapter 37, his robe of many colors was used to deceive his father. And in Genesis 39, his outer garment was used by Potiphar's wife to deceive her husband with false accusations against Joseph. But here, these new clothes are going to mean something else. This is going to be for Joseph's good in terms of the circumstances as well, not followed by immediate suffering as in the other cases. Here in verse 15, he comes before the king of Egypt. Egypt was the mightiest empire of this day. And Pharaoh would have been the most important monarch. And here into the palace comes lowly Hebrew Joseph. He'd been rejected. He'd been despised. He'd been imprisoned. He'd been falsely accused. He'd been forgotten. And here he is before Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, I've had a dream. And there's no one who can interpret it. And I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph says, well, it's not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Now, Joseph doesn't know the dream, so I don't know that he's saying the interpretation will necessarily be favorable here. This could be a way of saying Pharaoh's essentially asking, can you tell me the dream? And he's saying, you will get a favorable answer to that. Yes, yes, that will happen. The interpretation will be given, but not because of something in me. It's not like Pharaoh is just a better magician. It's not like it's not like Joseph is just a better magician than the ones in Egypt. Joseph doesn't have some sort of internal set of skills and powers to do this. This comes from the Lord. And this situation might remind you of a later biblical story when the prophet Daniel is exiled to Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar has dreams which trouble him. And yet nobody in the Babylonian court and none of his magicians can tell him what the dream means. Nebuchadnezzar summons his wise men, but they all fail. It was Daniel who could tell Nebuchadnezzar his dream. And it was because God granted him the wisdom and understanding for it. The later story of Daniel intentionally reflects this earlier narrative about Joseph. Daniel is like a later Joseph who rises in prominence and position in the court of a pagan king because of what God is doing providentially in that land. There's even a similar order of events when you read Daniel chapter 2. And at the end of Daniel chapter 2, when Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar the dream, Daniel gets promoted to an impressive position. And that happens in our story too. Numerous elements of connection from later story with Daniel to this one. And I think meant to be noticed by the readers of the Bible. So in verse 17, here's Pharaoh's account. Behold, in my dream, I was standing on the banks of the Nile. 7 cows, plump and attractive, came up out of it, fed on the reed grass. And then 7 others came out after them, poor, very ugly and thin, such as I had never seen in all the land of Egypt. Now, we didn't get that from the third person narration earlier, but Pharaoh says, by the way, they were the ugliest cows I'd ever seen. So he just wanted to add that commentary for Joseph. He says the thin, ugly cows ate up the first 7 plump cows. But when they'd eaten them, no one would have known that they had eaten them. They are still as ugly as at the beginning. So that's some new information as well. We didn't get that earlier. Pharaoh says, then I awoke. And then I also saw in my dream 7 ears growing on one stalk, full and good. 7 ears withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind, sprouted after them, and the thin ears swallowed up the 7 good ears, and I told it to the magicians. There was no one who could explain it to me. Verse 25. Here, Joseph says to Pharaoh, with no hesitation, just as it was the case with the cupbearer and the baker, Joseph is given understanding from the Lord. It's nothing within him. And he speaks with confidence and clarity. And he says the dreams of Pharaoh are one. Which is a way of saying each of these dreams, though they have different symbols and images, they mean the same thing. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. The language here is very interesting from Joseph's mouth. God has revealed some of the future. And it's not going to be something God is disengaged in. The language of Joseph is that God has revealed what he's about to do. Whatever's coming, it comes to pass by the will of God there in Egypt. And here in verse 26, Joseph begins to interpret the dream. He says, the good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good ears are 7. It would be the same 7 years. So the good elements in both dreams, the good cows and the good ears of grain, they both refer to a 7-year good period. And 7 empty ears, or excuse me, the dreams are 1. And then in verse 27, the 7 lean ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years. And the 7 empty ears blighted by the east wind are 7 years also of famine. So the good images in the story represent 7 years of plenty. And the bad images in the story represent 7 years of famine. God is revealing a general truth about the next 14 years in Egypt. They have 7 years of plenty that will be followed by 7 years of famine. In verse 28, it is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he's about to do. Joseph adds some more information in verses 29 to 32. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine that will follow, for it will be very severe. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. This is going to be something that this Pharaoh has to deal with during his reign over Egypt. It's going to come about shortly, and God's going to bring it to pass. God will shortly bring it about. This thing will happen. This is not a hypothetical scenario. Joseph says, here's what's coming, and God's going to do it. Joseph, though, takes the opportunity to say something in addition to the interpretation here. This is also part of Lord's plan to change the course of Joseph's life here in Egypt. In addition to these interpretations, Joseph offers some unsolicited counsel, some recommendations about what Pharaoh should do to prepare. After all, how are they going to prepare for 7 years of famine? Do you know how many thousands or millions of people would die over the course of those years without any food? Famine that was, in the language here, very severe. He says in verse 33, now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. So it seems that the next 7 years are going to have more than a sufficient amount of food. These coming 7 years are going to have so much that a 20% tax of it, if you will, a gathering of 20% of the abundance, can be taken away without any of the people being affected. And this abundance will be so great that if 20% of it is taken each year, it will help sustain the people who come to Egypt for the 7 years of famine after that. Joseph is helping Pharaoh understand that now is the time to act. Don't squander these next years of plenty. Instead, have people store some of it away every single year. Where? in verse 35, let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. Or the verb may mean let them guard it. So I think he's saying this food that's being gathered, somebody might really, really want some extra one time, but this is for the years of famine. So you're to gather it in these cities. You're to keep it guarded and protected. And in verse 36, that food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish. What is Joseph doing? Joseph is used of God in his wisdom and actions that the people might not perish. And had Joseph not done what he did, surely that is what exactly would have come to pass. Joseph is used of the Lord for the people's deliverance. And he's saying ahead of time, here's how the deliverance will come about. The last section of the chapter is verses 37 to 57, the fulfillment of Pharaoh's dreams. We're told in verse 37, this proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. They seem to not only be grateful for the interpretation, but that Joseph also followed it up with a plan. Recommendations and counsel, about 20% of extra grain each year for the 7 years of plenty. And that will help the 7 years of famine go without people perishing. Pharaoh says, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? This is the only person in the book of Genesis where the Spirit of God is associated with them. I mean, Pharaoh had earlier been told by Joseph, it's not in me. It is of God. And so Pharaoh, though he's polytheistic and believes in all kinds of gods, sees that indeed the one Joseph worships is active and engaged in Joseph's life. And Pharaoh says, well, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Pharaoh says to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there's none so discerning and wise as you are. These very kinds of patterns in Joseph's life are going to be noted later in the life of Daniel so many centuries in the future. Daniel is described by King Belshazzar of Babylon as someone who has the Spirit of God in Daniel 5:14. And the pagan king in Daniel's day, Nebuchadnezzar, concludes that Daniel is the wisest of all of his magicians and counselors in his court. And here, King Pharaoh is saying of Joseph, there is none so discerning or wise as you. And then the next words, here is his decree in verse 40. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. Pharaoh has just declared that Joseph will be in a position over everybody but Pharaoh. Joseph had been over everyone when he was in Potiphar's house. When he got put in prison, he was over everybody in the jailhouse. And now he's over everybody in Pharaoh's house, because this is how God has moved in Pharaoh's life every time. Oh, Joseph woke up in prison that morning. He woke up in prison, and by the time that day's over, everybody in Egypt will do as he commands. What a move of the providence of God. In verse 41, Pharaoh says, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And in verse 42, he takes his signet ring, which was important because the signet ring would have a mark of Pharaoh's authority so that Joseph could make decisions under the authority of Pharaoh. Joseph could act with Pharaoh's authority, commanding all in the land. And he's got the signet ring of Pharaoh. He puts it on Joseph's hand. And his hands that morning were shackled, according to the Psalms that reflect on Joseph's imprisonment. And now he's got Pharaoh's ring on it. And then he's clothed in garments of fine linen. And in verse 42, this is another mention of clothing in this chapter that brings about Joseph's vindication and position of rule. And that contrasts with the two earlier mentions of clothing in Genesis 37 and 39, which led to Joseph's despair and demise. Here, God is indeed up to something. And Joseph is bearing in this position all the accessories for it. Pharaoh's ring, garments of fine linen, and a chain of gold around his neck. In verse 43, he joins the royal motorcade. Pharaoh made him ride in his second chariot. And they called out before him, they called out before Joseph, "Bow the knee to people." Oh my. Woke up that morning in prison, riding by the end of the day in Pharaoh's second chariot. And when Joseph passes, people acknowledge physically the authority that Joseph has. Joseph is part of the royal motorcade here. What a position that has changed. Chariots were like limousines of the day. Now again, Pharaoh said, "You'll be over all the land other than the throne." So Pharaoh is still the king in Egypt, but you might call Joseph the second ruler, a vice regent, or a prime minister of Egypt. Someone who is indeed engaged in executive and administrative work, with authority over everyone under him. There was an evangelist and Baptist pastor in England during the 19th and 20th centuries named F.B. Meyer. And F.B. Meyer writes these words about Joseph's change of position in Genesis 41. I think this is so beautiful. F.B. Meyer says, "It was a wonderful ascent. Sheer in a single bound from the dungeon to the steps of the throne. His father had rebuked him. And now Pharaoh, the greatest monarch of his time, welcomes him. The hands that were hard with the toils of a slave are adorned with a signet ring. The feet are no longer tormented by fetters, a chain of gold linked now around his neck, the coat of many colors torn from him by violence and defiled by blood, and the garment left in the hand of the adulteress are exchanged for vestures of fine linen from the royal wardrobe. He was once trampled upon as the offscouring of all things, and now all Egypt is commanded to bow before him as he rides forth in the second chariot, prime minister of Egypt, second only to the king." God is at work in Joseph's life. Joseph did not understand these circumstances, but God can be trusted. And in verse 44, Pharaoh says to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Now, I think that's exaggeration. It's basically a way of saying people in the land are going to do what you tell them to do, including lifting up hands and feet, whichever way you want them to. That's the kind of authority he's endowed with. And in verse 45, along with the new things Joseph has just received, he gets an Egyptian name and an Egyptian wife. Verse 45 is interesting. It says Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, which isn't used after Genesis 41. The narrator continues to refer to him as Joseph. And he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. And her name is not mentioned after Genesis 41 either. These are two Egyptian names, one Joseph is given of himself, and then a wife, that appear for the purposes of Genesis 41. Because not only will the land be fruitful in these next years, Joseph is going to have a fruitful family. Lots of abundance and plenty are going to be happening. And this is preparing the way for that. In verse 46, we get the age. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh. If you remember how old he was when his brothers conspired against him, he was 17 in Genesis 37 when he told them his dreams and stirred up more their hatred. 17 years old there in Genesis 37, and now 13 years have gone by. During those 13 years, he has been forsaken, and he has been cast into a pit, and he's been sold, and he's been a slave, and he's been falsely accused, and he's been imprisoned. That's a lot in 13 years. And now he's in the service of Pharaoh and over all the land of Egypt, 30 years old. That's probably significant in the age because of later characters like David and Jesus. David comes to power in 2 Samuel 5:4 at age 30. And Jesus launches his public ministry at age 30 in Luke 3:23. Joseph then is foreshadowing people of future position and power, including the very king from Judah named David, and the final king who keeps the covenant with David with an eternal throne, Jesus himself. So in the providence of God, this age of 30 becomes significant, given the people to come. Joseph, though, is not from Judah's line. He's Judah's brother, so he can't be from Judah's line. They haven't had all these descendants yet in the tribes and the all that will be populating the land in later chapters. So while Joseph is not a ruler from the tribe of Judah, it's as if he's a foreshadowing of that, because he's in a position of rule and blessing. And the future king from Judah will be that and more. So Joseph isn't that promised king, but he's laying groundwork, and his in the shadows of his reign find a greater reality and counterpart in rulers to come. In verse 47, look at the fulfillment. Verse 47, during the seven plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly. That's exactly what Joseph said would happen. Verse 48, he gathered up all the food of those 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt and put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields around it. So the preparations came to pass just as he predicted it and advised it. In verse 49, Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. The abundance of grain is innumerable. So 20% of an innumerable, at least it seemed innumerable, 20% of an innumerable amount is not a small amount. So don't think of yourself in your minds as, well, just 1/5 of grain. We're not talking about the normal year of productivity. We're talking about such an abundance every year for 7 years that 20% of it would seem like a lot. That's what you should have in mind. It almost seemed uncountable. There was so much grain being stored aside. In verse 49, the phrase, like the sand of the sea, reminds us of Abraham and Jacob, where they were going to have the blessing of the Lord so at work in their life that their children would be like the sand of the sea and even the stars of the heavens. And so this reminds us that Joseph is in that line of God's promises and blessings, not only with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but through Joseph too. And here, the abundance of grain is noted. And in verse 50, before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. So not only was there fruitfulness with the grain, there was fruitfulness with the womb of Joseph's wife. Here he names them in verse 51 and 52. These names are significant. Verse 51, Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. Why? He says, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. And those two phrases probably go together in the sense of, he has made me to forget all the hardship in my father's house, which would have been the opposition of his brothers and ultimately what they did to him. The word Manasseh means making forget. So Joseph here is experiencing what seems like the long awaited cleansing of his mind and heart and emotions. And this will be important because he has a future encounter with his brothers that he does not know is coming. And yet God is already at work in the heart of Joseph, because after his brothers despised him and rejected him, he was sold as a slave and later accused and imprisoned. These 13 years for Joseph have not been great. They've been hard and difficult. And he pled for the cupbearer, please mention me to Pharaoh so that I can get out of what he called the pit. And yet, God is at work in Joseph's affliction. God is able to be at work in us in our affliction. And here Joseph, surrounded by those years of hardship, knows what the Lord has done here. He has made me forget all my hardship in my father's house. It doesn't mean that Joseph would never have had it in memory. I think it's a way of saying that he is on his way to forgiving and no longer holding it against his brothers. It would be easy for such a terrible loss and betrayal to so embitter him that he would be a hardened and angry and oppositional and antagonistic and hostile person. But that's not who Joseph is in this scene. God has made me forget all my hardship in all my father's house. It's as if God is revitalizing the soul and heart of Joseph. And in verse 52, here's the second one. The name of the second child he called Ephraim. For God has made me fruitful in in the land of my affliction. Joseph hasn't left the land of his affliction. He's in the land of his affliction and thriving. And we, by the grace and mercy of God, can thrive in affliction. The hardship and the suffering that Joseph has done, he does not believe God has forsaken him. He says in verse 51, God has made me to forget. And in verse 52, God has made me fruitful. Has God forgotten Joseph because things have been hard for 13 years? Far from it. Joseph just doesn't understand all the details of things that happened, but he trusts in God. God is worthy of trust in the land of affliction. God doesn't promise to deliver us out of the land of our affliction. He doesn't say, I will work with you and in you once it's over. Oftentimes we find that we are praying and trusting the Lord in the land of affliction and find our greatest periods of growth and thriving when things are difficult. God's purpose for Joseph to be fruitful took place in the land of hardship, in the land of Egypt, not in the promised land. And yet God had not forgotten him. God made him instead fruitful in the midst of difficulty. If you're in difficulty in what you might even call a land of affliction, friend, God has not forgotten you. Even year after year of hardship, these seasons of difficulty, God is using and working for your good. What we must determine in our minds and resolve in our hearts is that according to the word of God, he can be trusted. He can be trusted. In verses 53 and 54, the 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end. And the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt, in all the land of Egypt, there was bread. How is there bread in time of famine? Because so much innumerable, it seemed, amounts of grain had been gathered for 7 years. And now in verse 55, when all the land of Egypt was famished, people cried to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said, go to Joseph. What he says to you, do. Joseph's got the ring. He's got the golden chain. He's got the linen garments. Joseph looks the part, plays the part. He embodies this role of deliverer for the people that they might not perish. They need to go to him and he will save them. These storehouses have been stocked. And in verse 56, when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. But not just in Egypt. Here's what else was coming. And this sets the stage for what's going to happen next. In verse 57, moreover, all the earth came to Egypt. Which is a large and exaggerated way of saying, I think, there was famine far beyond the land of Egypt. People came from all over to Joseph. The people from the nations need to go to this guy because he can save them. Joseph has bread. They come to Joseph for the grain because the famine was severe over all the earth. They are famished. They are starving and none can help him. None can help them. But this man appointed by God for that time and place. Even the way I'm phrasing certain things, you should be thinking about Jesus. For in the fullness of time, he came to a world dead in sin and under God's condemnation. And the stage was set in this story and many other stories to come where patterns and prophecies prepared the way for the one appointed by God in the fullness of time to bring deliverance that they might not perish but have everlasting life. Joseph rides around on the chariot and they all had to bow the knee, but one greater than Joseph would come. And every tongue will confess he is Lord and every knee will bow. For Christ is Lord, and he's been given the name above every name. Jesus is second to nobody on earth. He is greater than every ruler and monarch, a kingdom that will forever last. Joseph here in this story gives us glimmers of the ultimate promise to Abraham in Genesis 12:3, where God said to Abraham, "In you all the families of the earth will be blessed." And Joseph is like a small micro example of God through Joseph blessing this land and these families and all families of the earth that are coming to Egypt. If they'll come to this person, there's blessing under his authority. And all the knee will bow to Christ, for he is the fulfillment of the seed of Abraham. In him all families of the earth will be blessed if they come to him. And he did what he did on the cross, and he did what he did rising from the dead, and he did what he did ascending on high, that we might not perish, but instead have a faithful Redeemer and a faithful High Priest. Christ gives us something better than grain. He is everlasting bread. He says, "I am the bread of life. And the one who eats of me will never hunger and die." Christ comes to give us sustenance that our soul needs, that we will live forever in the taking of by faith. Christ was rejected and despised and arrested and murdered. You think the ascent of Joseph is impressive? Wait till you get to the gospel. When Jesus on the cross prays for the forgiveness of his enemies, for on the third day rises from the dead, never to die again. Greater than an ascent that Joseph had. Jesus ascends to the right hand of God with authority over all heaven and earth, greater than anything Joseph had. And Jesus reigns over all the earth. Oh, friend, that we would go to him, that we would trust in him, that we would fall before him, bowing the knee, confessing with the mouth, trusting with the heart, for Jesus is Lord and the name alone that can save. God is so merciful. God is merciful to us this morning because we've been able with our ears to hear about a Savior. And he did not come in a vacuum of biblical story with no precedent. No, God had raised up deliverer after deliverer, all paving the way and pointing to the one who would surpass them all, the great Christ, who is King of kings and Lord of lords. Oh, they would love him, worship him, follow him. He is worthy.